The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
How many people take their holiday photos on a warm, sunny beach? Now you can with an amazing getaway at an even more amazing price. The Pineapple Beach Club in Antigua. Right now, for just $99 per person per night, you can enjoy an adult-only, all-inclusive holiday getaway on a white, sandy beach. Go to pineapplebeachclub.com or call 800-772-8711 to make your reservation today. Let's tell you a little bit more about the resort and the island. First off, it's all-inclusive. Meals, snacks, beverages, resort activities, and all taxes and service charges are included. What's on site? How about five restaurants, the Tranquility Spa, two fresh pools, windsurfing, snorkeling, kayaking, sailing, and so much more? Are you planning a destination wedding? They can do that too. Antigua is located right in the Caribbean and known for magnificent weather, pristine white sand beaches, and colorful cultural festivals. Don't wait. This offer expires soon. Call 800-772-8711 or go to pineapplebeachclub.com. You don't want to miss out on this offer. See website for complete details.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. With the presidential campaign a virtual dead heat, Donald Trump talked about his health with Dr. Oz.
Your doctors or your family ever give you a hard time about your weight?
Yeah, I think I could lose a little weight. I've always been a little bit this way.
And Nancy Cordes reports on hacked emails from General Colin Powell.
Everything HRC touches, she kind of screws up with hubris.
I really, really, really want to elect Hillary Clinton.
President Obama was out campaigning this week as Charlie Rose asked Bill Clinton.
But why are they attracted to Donald Trump?
Well, because he promises.
Who lives high above Manhattan in a luxury penthouse.
He's brilliant at rubbing salt in their wounds.
And Hillary Clinton appeared to collapse last weekend at Ground Zero. Then she took a break from campaigning.
The good news is my pneumonia finally got some Republicans interested in women's health.
I'm Howard Arenstein in Washington. As Election Day approaches, more and more of the news is taken up by this crazy campaign in which Donald Trump is still dealing with where he thinks President Obama was born.
Hillary Clinton and her campaign of 2008 started the birther controversy. I finished it. President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period.
Trump refused to say that in an interview with the Washington Post on Thursday and took new criticism from Clinton.
He was asked one more time, where was President Obama born? And he still wouldn't say Hawaii. He still wouldn't say America.
The latest CBS News New York Times poll has the race in a virtual tie. And Trump is doing better in many battleground states, giving him more possible paths to the presidency. Here's what correspondent Nancy Cordes reported on Friday morning.
Clinton returned to the campaign trail with a wave and a tongue-in-cheek new theme song.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't.
Determined to send a message that she's on the mend.
Nobody ever accuses me of quitting, and I will never give up. I'll never walk away, no matter how tough the going gets. I'm actually asking Americans to hold me accountable for my ideas and hold my opponent accountable for his.
When it comes to those ideas, the new CBS News New York Times poll finds voters think Clinton would do a better job handling terrorism, immigration, and foreign policy. But they say Trump would do a better job with the economy. And that's their number one issue. Trump's voters are also more likely than Clinton's to say they are very enthusiastic about voting.
It's important to sit with your thoughts every now and then.
In Greensboro, Clinton said her sick days had given her time to reflect on the kind of race she wants to run in the final 7 weeks.
I want to give Americans something to vote for, not just against. With all the noise and distraction, it's important to focus on what really matters and the real choice in this election.
She'd like to put her illness behind her, but was asked repeatedly why her running mate wasn't informed about her pneumonia diagnosis until she nearly fainted at Ground Zero.
We communicated. We've communicated, but I am, not going to go into our personal conversations, and I feel very comfortable and confident about our relationship.
Before she left the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton gave Donald Trump some ammunition to use against her when she derided his supporters as deplorable. Here's a report from correspondent Major Garrett.
To just be grossly generalistic, you can put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Hillary Clinton named it all right, gross generalizations and all.
She divides people into baskets as though they were objects, not human beings.
And adding a new layer of division to the already divisive Trump-Clinton debate, one Trump sought to exploit with this new TV ad.
You know what's deplorable? Hillary Clinton viciously demonizing hard-working people like you.
Trump did not do all the talking. He brought supporters on stage to testify and subtly assail Clinton.
My wife and I represent non-deplorable people.
Clinton later said she was wrong to generalize about Trump's supporters, but stood by the suggestion Trump has emboldened racist voices, among them Louisiana Republican David Duke, a former Grand Wizard of the KKK. Trump's running mate, however, pushed Duke away, but stopped short of describing him as deplorable.
We don't want his support, and we don't want the support of people who think
so. You call him a deplorable. You would call him a deplorable.
No, I don't. I'm not in the name-calling business, Wolf. You know me better than that. What Hillary Clinton did was shocking.
Republican vice presidential candidate Mike Pence interviewed on CNN by Wolf Blitzer. And speaking of shocking, the federal government ordered a recall of Samsung's latest smartphone, the Galaxy Note 7, after numerous reports of exploding batteries. Here's correspondent Chris Van Cleve.
There are at least 92 reports of the battery inside this phone overheating. That's resulted in 26 cases of burn injuries and 55 reports of property damage. That includes fires. The message, turn this phone off.
Even a small lithium-ion battery can cause blistering flames if it malfunctions. The Consumer Product Safety Commission's Elliot Kay.
It starts charring or it gets overheated. Step away from the phone.
The government's consumer watchdog calls the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phone a serious fire hazard.
Please, please power it down and return it.
Samsung's U.S. president apologized Thursday.
We did not meet the standard of excellence that you expect and deserve. For that, we apologize.
The FAA says the only way to fly with the phone is by turning it off, keeping it unplugged on board, and out of checked baggage.
I've never seen a single product singled out like this as do not turn this phone on a plane. We strongly suggest this, or if we're an airline, we're not going to let you use this phone on our plane.
Dan Ackerman is senior editor at CNET. He says Samsung fumbled and strung out a crucial recall.
The whole recall process really took a lot longer than anybody thought because Samsung kind of tried to do it by themselves at first.
Kay from the CPSC agrees. He said Samsung should have brought in the government right away to handle the recall.
In my mind, anybody who thinks that a company going out on its own is going to provide the best recall for that company and, more importantly, for the consumer needs to have more than their phone checked.
Strong words there. 97% of these phones that were sold in the U.S. and about a million or so have been sold in the U.S. have the defective battery. And there are reports the CPSC is looking into other Samsung devices that have had fire issues.
Correspondent Chris Van Cleve. Coming up, Colin Powell gets hacked and the candidates release more health information. Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. More files and emails were leaked this week, some about the use of medications by Olympic athletes, but many others taken from the servers of the Democratic National Committee, and some very embarrassing ones from the private email account of former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Nancy Cordes has that story.
These emails are from Powell's Gmail account, and they were posted by an anonymously run website called DC Leaks that is suspected of having ties to Russian intelligence. His emails to friends, colleagues, and reporters show that he was deeply resentful that Clinton and her supporters were comparing her use of a private account as Secretary of State to his.
The hacked emails reveal deep tensions between Powell and the Clinton campaign. In them, Powell says he met with Clinton's advisors in August to discuss burying the email flap. Sad thing, Powell writes, Clinton could have killed this 2 years ago by merely telling everyone honestly what she had done and not tie me to it. I told her staff 3 times not to try that gambit. I had to throw a mini tantrum at a Hamptons party to get their attention. In another email from a year earlier, Powell tells a business associate, I told you about the speaking gig that I lost at a university because she so overcharged them, adding, everything HRC touches, she kind of screws up with hubris.
I really, really, really want to elect Hillary Clinton.
President Obama made his first solo appearance for her, attacking Trump with gusto in Philadelphia.
I mean, he wasn't going to let you on his golf course. He wasn't going to let you buy in his condo. And now suddenly this guy's going to be your champion?
The president also took a victory lap of sorts in Philadelphia, touting a new federal report that shows that household income rose by more than 5% in 2015, a record and the first such increase since 2007. He said that this shows that his policies are working, and he said only one candidate is going to continue those policies, and that's Hillary Clinton.
Correspondent Nancy Cordes, the candidates' medical histories were the focus of much of the attention this past week, and Donald Trump made an appearance on the Dr. Oz show, where correspondent Major Garrett reports Trump asked the audience if they wanted to see the results of his physical.
Why not share your medical records?
Well, I have really no problem in doing it. I have it right here. I mean, should I do it? I don't care. Should I do it?
Reviewing results of a recent physical, Trump discussed campaign weight gain and pondered being the nation's oldest president.
And I don't know if this makes sense. I feel as good today as I did when I was 30.
You're 6'3", 236 pounds. In my mind, I'm thinking your BMI is high. It's probably close to 30, which is sort of the barrier for most people. Yeah. Do your doctors or your family ever give you a hard time about your weight?
Yeah, I think I could lose a little weight. I've always been a little bit this way. You know, I've sort of always been that. I was probably a good swimmer. Yeah, if I had one thing, I'd like to lose weight. It's tough because of the way I live. But the one thing I would like to do is be able to drop 15, 20 pounds. It would be good.
Trump and Clinton both released new letters from their doctors, not full medical histories. On CBS This Morning, Dr. Tara Narula, a CBS News medical consultant, talked about the candidate's health with Gail King, Charlie Rose, and Nora O'Donnell.
Is a letter the same as medical records?
It's not. Okay. You know, medical records document all the information appropriately. A letter is going to depend on what you include in that letter.
We know he's on statins.
Right, which are medications used to treat high cholesterol or to lower your risk of cardiovascular disease if you're considered at high risk.
And he says he doesn't exercise really, and that he loves fast food. Some people would say that, you know, campaigning is a form of shows how much stamina you have. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly it requires energy and stamina, no doubt, but you can have not so great health and still be able to survive a campaign trail without any events. So it's not really a great or the greatest marker of your health.
Okay. All right. Hillary Clinton released a letter. You can click on it on her website that revealed some details about her medical history. What did we learn?
So we learned that she basically has a history of blood clots, and that's why she's on the Coumadin. We know she's on Coumadin for that. Hypothyroidism. She takes thyroid replacement medication. B12, Claritin. She's also taking levofloxacin, which is the medication for her pneumonia. We learned a lot about her cardiovascular health. As a cardiologist, very important. This is the number one killer of women in this country. She has a normal blood pressure. She has no evidence of diabetes. She has a well-controlled lipid panel, cholesterol panel. And most importantly, she had a calcium score of 0. That means there was no evidence of hard or calcified plaque in her heart arteries. That portends a very good prognosis over the next 5 or 10 years of low risk of cardiac mortality.
A previously undisclosed surgery, too, a small tube inserted in her ear for sinus infection.
That's right. And interestingly, we also found out that she had a CAT scan of her brain done in the setting of these sinus infections that was normal, which a lot of people would like to know, given her history of a blood clot in her brain that she had back in 2012.
So does her overall health sound good to you based on what you see there?
I mean, certainly based on what we know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing there that stands out as being an issue. But, you know, not being her doctor, I can't really comment anything else.
And how much will all of this affect voters' decisions? CBS News political director John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation on Sundays, spoke about that on CBS This Morning.
The big question, obviously, is one, are they fit and healthy for office? But then more broadly, every time there are one of these transparency questions about what the candidates are releasing and what their instincts are, should they release a lot? Are they giving the public everything the public needs? We're getting some sense of their patterns of openness. And that matters because they'll take those patterns into the office themselves. And whether they're going to be transparent in a campaign will tell us whether they'll be transparent in office. And that matters not just in terms of what they'll disclose, but how sensitive they'll be when no one's looking to kind of following the rules and doing things by the book.
Bill Clinton said, why are we having such a fuss about having the flu?
Well, he wants to call it the flu. We're having a fuss because she collapsed there on video. He knows the power of images. He also knows that she does have a health history. She has blood clots. There are these issues. And so it's not just, you know, some passing thing. It's a moment here. And also we're having a fuss about it because the way the campaign handled it, admittedly, they say not very well in terms of letting the reporters know what was going on, exacerbates her sort of signature problem, which is this question of trustworthiness. And so this goes to something the campaign should want to try and fix because it's one of her liabilities.
Some fascinating details inside the CBS News, New York Times poll suggesting an enthusiasm gap in favor of Donald Trump.
Right. You know, when Hillary Clinton mentioned her basket of deplorables, when she was talking about Trump voters, you know, there were some people who were trying to figure out, was that a gaffe? Was that part of strategy? There is a part of the Clinton strategy, which is to remind base voters in the Democratic Party of what they think of Donald Trump. And so that was, in some people's view, an effort to increase that enthusiasm by basically terrifying Democratic voters about Donald Trump. The thing about enthusiasm, though, is now with targeting and with many days of elections where you could, in some states, the voting period is a month, you can work your voters in a way that you can improve those enthusiasm numbers. So it's really important to see where people lack enthusiasm, what states, and what the turnout operation is in those states.
Political director John Dickerson. Coming up, Hillary Clinton's health scare and Charlie Rose's interview with former President Bill Clinton. Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of the show can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time so you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. Hillary Clinton spent some of this week resting at home after a health scare on Sunday. Correspondent Nancy Cordes reported this on Tuesday morning.
Clinton acknowledged in a phone interview with CNN last night that her dizzy spell on Sunday is something that has happened to her a couple of times before when she has gotten dehydrated. But she shrugged off the notion that her decision to initially keep her pneumonia diagnosis to herself signals a lack of transparency.
I just didn't think it was going to be that big a deal.
In the 8-minute interview from her Chappaqua home, Clinton described what led her legs to buckle beneath her as she was helped into her van at Ground Zero.
I could feel how hot and humid it was. I felt overheated, and I did lose my balance for a minute. But once I got in, once I could sit down, once I could cool off, once I had some water, I immediately started feeling better.
She said she has talked to her staff about the time it took to inform the public.
In retrospect, we probably could have released more information more quickly.
Clinton press secretary Ryan Fallon.
Was there a discussion among your communications team about whether or not to announce that Secretary Clinton had pneumonia?
Secretary Clinton, I think that she felt that this is a common thing that people have in terms of pneumonia. A lot of people will work through things like this.
Clinton rejected suggestions that she had been too secretive.
Compare everything you know about me with my opponent. I think it's time he met the same level of disclosure that I have for years.
Her supporters rallied to her defense. New York Senator Chuck Schumer disclosed he too was recovering from pneumonia. And Vice President Joe Biden, campaigning for Clinton in Charlotte, said there is nothing for voters to worry about.
Hillary's health is good. I've had pneumonia. I don't know about any of you. Yes. I've had walking pneumonia. Yes. What you do is you take antibiotics and you rest a little bit.
Vice President Joe Biden. Correspondent Charlie Rose had a chance to interview former President Bill Clinton and asked him about his wife's health.
Rarely, but on more than one occasion over the last many, many years, the same sort of things happened to her when she just got severely dehydrated. She's worked like a demon, as you know, as Secretary of State and as a senator, and in the years since.
But more importantly, she's on a grueling campaign.
Yeah.
There is also this, though, that people say between a cough that she had and having to take medicine for that and now the discovery, that this has made her health a campaign issue.
They think everything's a campaign issue. I think her lifestyle and her underlying indicators, from blood pressure to amount of exercise to everything else, means it's almost certain she's in better health than her opponent. I saw the interview with his doctor. I'm sure you did, too.
I did, yes.
So let's get a little serious here. They'll do the right thing. Just wait to see. She's going to be fine, and they'll do the right thing.
Charlie Rose also asked Bill Clinton if he understands why Donald Trump is doing so well against his wife, who has more experience in the government.
When you go a long time without a pay raise, when you think your future is bleak, when you worry that you can't provide for your children, and at the same time, your borders seem more like nets than walls in a negative way, you have these terrorist incidents occurring, you have the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II, and massive cultural change, you have a period of disorientation where people are often just reacting serially.
But why are they attracted to Donald Trump?
Well, because he promises...
Who lives high above Manhattan in a luxury penthouse.
Because he told them that he's brilliant at rubbing salt in their wounds. He makes them dislike other people and says, I'll fix it all and make it the way it used to be.
But why is Secretary Clinton, who has an agenda, an economic agenda, having less appeal to working class Americans than you did? They were your constituency, and she has a program, and Donald Trump is getting more of their vote. Why is that?
Well, that's been steadily the case. It started in the 1960s, and it's just kind of going on. But you got to understand, a lot of this is cultural. She's the first woman candidate for a major office. She's trying to get the third term of a party. Winning a third term in a row is difficult. If you look at what she's advocated and what he's advocated, she's advocating positive change. How do you build on the good things that have been done in the Obama years, but go well beyond it? He's advocating a return to trickle-down economics on steroids, which got us in trouble in the first place.
And Charlie Rose asked Bill Clinton about the controversy over the Clinton Foundation, which Trump has called a criminal enterprise.
I've been over backwards to try to make sure there was no conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest. We reached an agreement with the White House before Hillary became Secretary of State about how all donations would be handled and how the foundation would be run.
You were saying with respect to the foundation and whatever might have taken place with the foundation, any access to the Secretary of State, there is nothing to apologize for, nothing happened, there were no consequences, and we have been as transparent as we should and can. Is that what you're saying?
I believe, first of all, we have been as transparent as we can be, and we've been more transparent than any other foundation, more transparent than any other foundation has ever been asked to be, and certainly more transparent than anybody else in this line of work is. I have said that to the best of my knowledge, nobody ever got anything from the State Department because they supported the Clinton Foundation. If they did and it was inappropriate, I would say that was wrong, too. I have proved that I'm not averse to apologizing for things that I think were wrong.
Everybody wonders this question. If your wife is president, and you've answered it 1,000 times, but help me understand it with a bigger and better answer, what might you do?
There are lots of things I could do.
Like?
I'd like to be sent to all these places that have been left out and left behind. I believe this country is so close to being able to really grow again in a way that lifts everybody. Close. I think the things we need to do are affordable, achievable, and fairly straightforward. I think they're threatened by political gridlock at home and trouble around the world. Trouble in terms of slow growth, trouble in terms of turmoil. But I have been in the weeds for 15 years. You know, like, how do you actually do this stuff? I'm not as good as I used to be with politics. But if you sent me to Puerto Rico to figure out how they could work their way out of bankruptcy, I could do that. If you sent me to Indian country and figured out how they could diversify their economy by selling wind and solar energy and using the cash to do something else and getting affordable broadband, I could do that. If you sent me to coal country and figured out how we could use the new market tax credit to give them a whole different economy, I could do that. So I'd be good at that, I think.
Former President Bill Clinton speaking with Charlie Rose on his possible future role at the White House. I'm Howard Arenstein in Washington.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Raviv. You know or should know the humorist, columnist, author, Dave Barry. He's got a new book out called Best State Ever. Of course, he means his own state. The subtitle, A Florida Man Defends His Homeland. So, Dave Barry, defends it from what? You think Florida's been under attack?
It has. It's been constantly, relentlessly attacked for being weird and stupid. And that's because it is weird and stupid, but I can explain why.
This is like guilty with an explanation, okay.
Yes, exactly. We only have 6% of the nation's population, and yet we produce, as a state, 57% of the nation's weirdness. But my argument is that a lot of the times, if you look at these stories, these Florida man stories, Florida woman stories, and there are so many of them, the people involved aren't from here. They came here, and they can't get out of here. It's like the scientific explanation is like if you were to put rats in a box, and the box is a rectangle except for the lower right-hand corner. There's this, like a little corridor going off. The rats would all go down and explore that corridor. And the smart ones, even the sort of average intelligence ones, would eventually be able to figure out how to get back out of there. Mm. The stupid rats cannot.
Now that's funny, but you are, you know, describing your neighbors, the people who've been reading your columns for decades, like stupid. What I'm wondering is, do Floridians have a sense of humor when you poke fun at them?
Absolutely. That's one of the wonderful things about this state. Every other state has a certain measure of state pride. And if you knock their state, they don't say, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Kansas is a great place.
Yeah.
Florida, nobody does that. Everybody goes, yeah, this is a weird place.
I see. And they kind of enjoy it. All right.
Would be, you know, mostly they assume when I'm talking about stupid, weird people, they think, well, he doesn't mean me.
Can I ask you on a serious level, there being a high Hispanic or Latino population, I mean, I don't know if they read your column. Is it translated into Spanish regularly?
No, it is not. But I live in Miami. My wife is, in fact, Cuban.
You know that culture, but I was sort of wondering if in any way your sense of humor, this book, Best State Ever, etc., you know, is a white Anglo-Floridian kind of laughing at everyone else for being stupid.
Well, I don't think people view it that way. Miami, as you know, is basically second, third generation Cuban Americans. They are as American as any American. They speak fluent English and whatever. And they have a terrific sense of humor. But I think most, to me, it crosses all racial, all ethnic, all age lines, the general feeling that, yes, people come here, do weird things, do stupid things, That's our nature as a state.
And they make headlines, and sometimes they're big negatives. Sometimes they are funny. I mean, right now, the Zika virus, of course, is not funny. It's engendering real concern. But it's the geographic fact, right? Being in that lower right corner, as you put it, you're closest to the Caribbean and trouble that can come from the south.
Yeah, we are really much, especially in South Florida, we're almost a foreign country, and that's a joke that's been made by many, but it feels true when you're down here. It's such an exotic place. It has so many different cultures kind of stewing in the sun here that it doesn't feel like any other part of the United States at all.
By the way, though our chat is somewhat serious, I mean, the book isn't. You make up a lot of so-called facts, and you have a lot of photographs. The photos are real. Your history is a little fuzzy, would you agree?
Yes. Well, among other things, I write that Florida didn't find out about the Civil War until 1883, when it was too late to get involved. No, that's not true. We probably found out right after it ended.
Hey, one thing before I go, just to know, you do still live in Florida, though you could have moved to Hollywood when they turned your books into movies. You could be on a beautiful mountain stream in Colorado. You do still live in Florida.
I do, because I am a humor writer, and this is the mother lode. I would be a fool to leave.
Dave Barry, author, this time, of Best State Ever. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We have a chance to talk with a successful novelist who knows almost everything about New York City and its environs and gets to show it off so far in three big novels that have really made a big impact. But you have to wait a few years in between. I'm talking about Jay McInerney, who's about to join us. Perhaps you know his previous books, Brightness Falls, The Good Life. There's a new one called Bright Precious Days. Once again, Jay, you feature your fictional couple, Corinne and Russell Calloway. So bring us up to date. It's been how many years since The Good Life?
It's actually been 10 years since I published The Good Life. And The Good Life followed Russell and Corinne Calloway, my fictional couple, and their circle of friends in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. Like many New Yorkers, I was at a loss as to, you know, how to process that event. As a writer, what to make of it, and eventually I thought about returning to this couple that I had first introduced in a book called Brightness Falls, published in 1992.
Jay, most of our listeners are not high-powered New Yorkers, right? They're all over the United States, and they're probably thinking, oh, these Calloways, they should just tone it down, live within their means. But it leads to a broader question. You know, in Bright Precious Days and your previous novels, is this really only about spoiled New Yorkers? Is there an appeal for Americans in general?
I think Russell and Corinne are dealing with the exact same problems that most couples are. You know, the scale in New York might be a little different, but the fact is they're struggling to educate their kids. They're struggling to find a living space that's reasonably capacious. They're struggling with the big questions of the meaning of life and fidelity and what they want their legacy to be. I think in many ways they're very representative. They just happen to live in this big stage of Manhattan.
Now, Jay, everybody praises your writing, so you don't have to say it, right? F. Scott Fitzgerald style, and maybe that's why people all around the world, even if they lived in a cave in a foreign country, would like to read your books and think, oh, if only I lived with money in New York.
I think New York is a place that fascinates people around the world. Whether you love it or whether you hate it, it's probably the most glamorous, the most prosperous, the most industrious place on earth. I think what happens here matters and reverberates throughout the world. But again, you know, people here, myself included, are wrestling with the same basic problems of existence that everyone does.
What is the meaning of life? It comes up even more often as folks get a little older. Now, can I ask you this? After three novels, even after Bright Precious Days, are you going to stick with Corinne and Russell?
Well, that's a good question. Curiously, some of the reviewers have asked me to write a sequel, something that pleased and surprised me. You know, there's something very neat about a trilogy, but I suspect it's possible that I might revisit them just one more time.
That's Jay McInerney joining us by Skype. Your latest novel is called Bright Precious Days. Jay McInerney, thanks very much.
Thanks, Dan. Good to talk to you.
And now our weekend roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. In my experience, most people don't spend a lot of time examining their lives. I wouldn't say that makes their lives not worth living, but it's certainly a good idea for all of us to examine our behavior. The hardest person to see is ourself. That's all the more reason for self-examination. A good question to ask is, at certain times would you want to be around you? If you're able to see that about yourself, you can address it and everyone will be happier. I'm Charles Grove with the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Coming up, a new museum on the National Mall in Washington, the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
That and more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from, and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Howard Arenstein. The new Museum of African American History and Culture opens this month in the shadow of the Washington Monument and just a short distance from the White House, home of the first African American president. President Obama will speak at the official opening next weekend. CBS This Morning got a sneak preview. Correspondents Gail King and Nora O'Donnell spoke with founding director Lonnie Bunch about the museum, which fills the last remaining empty space on the National Mall.
On the mall, it's mainly white marble. And I thought, could we do something that gave a little color to this?
In more ways than one.
Well, and then that's what I realized.
Wrapped in bronze and inspired by the three-tiered crowns used in West African art, the National Museum of African American History and Culture shines brightly near the center of the National Mall.
This is a cabin from Edisto Island, South Carolina.
But to get a sense of the African American experience, you have to go below the surface, five stories down.
At its peak, it would hold between 8 and 16 people. Would be in that cabin.
A cabin for slaves and shackles small enough to restrain a child, reminders of America's regretful past.
After World War II, the notion of sit-ins really caught on.
While a stool from a Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter represents a resolve to move beyond segregation.
What I see is something very simple. Sitting in a chair is transformative.
This museum will challenge your emotions. Tears will be shed here. But there's joy to be found, too.
Okay. Got to say, this is cool.
Like Chuck Berry's cherry red Cadillac.
Did you sit in the driver's seat?
You know, you're supposed to treat artifacts with respect, but of course I sat in there. Are you kidding me?
About 40,000 artifacts have been collected. The fact that less than 10% of it is on display is emblematic of the pride and dedication that made this museum a reality.
So I'm very humbled. I think in some ways my biggest worry was, could we find the stuff?
After President George W. Bush signed legislation to create the museum in 2003, Congress designated $270 million, or half of what it would cost, to build it. Over $300 million more came through fundraising efforts, while corporate partners, business leaders, and celebrities were the top donors. $4 million came from people giving whatever they could afford. Like the $1 million pledged by the congregation of the Alfred Street Baptist Church in Alexandria, Virginia.
The church tried to emphasize that every gift mattered and wanted every member to believe that no matter how large or small your gift, you're making history.
People are going to be able to leave their stories behind. Ultimately, their picture and their story
here
will be here.
Visitors can add their history, too, using an interactive display. But the newest Smithsonian Museum is not a time capsule. It's a place where you will be encouraged to explore current events, including the complicated conversations of race that continue today.
Former Secretary of State and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, serves on the museum's council. He spoke about the significance of this month's opening on CBS This Morning with Gail King, Nora O'Donnell, and Charlie Rose.
Speak to the idea of what this means to you, what it means to African Americans, and what it means to Americans.
Let me start with America. It means a lot to America because this isn't just African American history, it's American history. And it's filling a gap that has existed in American history for so many years. This has been in concept for 100 years. And now it's here, and it's beautiful, it's magnificent, and it's different from any other thing on the Mall. And I think the American people are going to love coming to this place and completing this part of our wonderful history of this great country.
And to African Americans?
And to African Americans, of course. You know, I want to go in there and see Chuck Berry's Cadillac. I want to see my uniform.
Yes. What do you make of the timing of it now, General Powell, when we are really having some racial issues again in 2016, that this museum is opening now at this particular time?
I think it's important at this time for this museum to open because it shows that we've come a long way, but the struggle's not over. Remember what the founding fathers said. We're always striving to become a more perfect union. They never said we are perfect. We are striving to become more perfect. And that is a striving that has to continue. And the problems that face us now are more than just the color of your skin. It's economic opportunity, educational opportunity, housing opportunity. And that's what we have to work on. And those are the issues that I think are still facing the country, and especially the African American community.
Charlie Rose toured the museum with the only two African-American senators, Cory Booker of New Jersey, a Democrat, and Tim Scott of South Carolina, a Republican, who became emotional as he talked about the opening of the new museum.
I'll tell you, when I walked in here, I first thought about my grandfather, who passed away in January of this year. I thought about taking him to vote for the first African-American president, a day that he never thought would come. Walking in here, understanding the weight of history, the gravity of the circumstances that we face as a nation, encouraged me, saddened me, and made me understand the important role that we can play in making this country better together.
As senators?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, is that you come from two very different backgrounds. You're the Democratic senator from New Jersey, Republican senator from South Carolina.
Yes.
You came from single mother,
single parent household. Poor, did not do really well in school, so my story really is a kid that almost flunked out of high school. You got a Rhodes Scholar over here, so we have a contrast in our experience growing up.
And what unites you?
I think a lot. People would expect somebody who's, I joke with them, far out there on the right, yeah. and myself on the left. But there is a kinship and a bond I felt with Tim almost instantly, a friendship, a commonality of experiences. We may have come out of two different backgrounds, but we share a common heritage and a common experience.
Both senators hope this historic museum will serve as validation,
my goodness,
as well as proof of how far we have come.
It does seem to be necessary for us to remind ourselves of where we've been.
And an inspiration for how far we need to go.
I hope that one of the beauties of this museum being here will be an understanding and appreciation of the depth of the pain, agony, and tragedy of slavery. I hope that the weight of the past will slow your gait and bow your head. And as you walk out here, I hope that the sense of freedom and a sense of expectations will overwhelm you, and that you will feel individually responsible for making America the most amazing country for every single citizen in our land.
Senators Tim Scott and Cory Booker on the new National Museum of African American History and Culture, opening next weekend on the Mall here in Washington.
Our thanks to you for listening. Anytime you want to hear us, including previous episodes, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. And remember our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. The Weekend Roundup is produced in Washington by Howard Arenstein. Have a great week. I'm Dan Revive, CBS News.